I'm Christopher Lighton, unspooling this sort of Godfather movie that's broken out in Syria, a very hard case in this Arab Spring. We're with the professional Syria watcher, Stephen Heidemann, from the U.S. Institute of Peace. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Watching Syria this spring, Steve Heidemann, it's hard not to see the strongman's son, Bashar Assad, as Michael Corleone. The Godfather's kid in Syria was trained to be an eye doctor, but then he was forced to take over the family business. And when trouble started closing in this spring, he started shooting unmercifully, as Michael Corleone, of course, did in the Al Pacino role in The Godfather. Shall we dig into the Godfather analogy, or should we kick it out the window?
I think it's an interesting place to begin because it's enormously revealing, and it tells us, on one hand, a great deal about how Syria operates in one sense. And on the other, I think, is a useful way to underscore how that metaphor, that narrative about Syria as dominated by a family mafia, limits our understanding of what's happening in the country. There is, to be sure, a certain amount of truth in thinking about politics in Syria as dominated by a single family. The Assad family has been at the peak of Syrian politics since before Bashar's father, Hafiz, actually seized power in 1970. He was a key player behind the scenes in Syrian politics during much of the 1960s. And so we have a period of at least 40 years and perhaps longer in which this family has really pulled many of the strings in Syria. And Syria, to be fair, is not that different from its neighbors in that regard, many of which have been run by powerful families who have used their positions of power to enrich themselves and their family members and to govern through a combination of means that absolutely includes brutality, torture, repression, and so on. And
blowing
so,
up whole cities.
Blowing
like
up
it.
Whole cities as in Hama in February 1982 after facing a long insurgency from the Muslim Brotherhood, the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood. It culminated in that massive act of
violence.
Among
other things, if I can just say, Steve, it adds for me the human interest that when you see these protesters in Damascus, you say, my God, the kid in Beijing who stood in front of the tank, that was nothing compared to sort of staring down the barrel of the guns of the Gotti mob in Syria. These are mean, nasty, rough, awfully brutal people.
They can be. They can be. And I think when they feel that they confront an existential threat, that's when they show the world their worst. And we're seeing it now, to be sure. But let's also be aware that what happens when we think about politics in Syria through the lens of this mafia metaphor is that we imagine that what we're dealing with is not an authoritarian system of rule with institutions and processes and procedures and a ruling party and an infrastructure that extends across the entire country and the capacity to manage problems of governance in ways that are bureaucratic, not simply patronage-based or not simply as if he sits in his office and gives orders to his consigliere and they get carried out. There's an enormously simplifying effect that happens when we think about Syria in terms of the Corleones that I think does a disservice. Why? Because it suggests on one hand that if we got rid of this family, we could solve Syria's problems. We ran into that in Iraq. Getting rid of the guy at the top did not solve Iraq's problems. When we dismantled one of the critical institutions in Iraq, the Ba'ath Party and the military, we found ourselves facing a power vacuum and had to reconstruct a system of governance that was, as it turns out, both sectarian and extraordinarily violent in its own right. And so we have to be careful about placing too much weight on metaphors that create false understandings about how Syrian society and Syrian politics work.
But before we give it up, though, I want to hear you on father and son in the Assad family, specifically the fact that Bashar was said, even in January of 2011, that the winds of change were coming. This is going to be a reformable situation, and that he himself, with a medical training in Europe, was up to a different program.
Let me take the bigger question of Syria's relationship to these broader processes of change and that interview that you mentioned in the Wall Street Journal back in January, because it tells us, again, some important things about Syria, I think. Bashar was acknowledging, when he talked about reform and the need for reform, that Syria confronts many of the same kinds of conditions, social conditions, economic conditions, that are present in other countries where protests had already broken out. Very high youth unemployment, corruption, limited economic opportunities for Syrian citizens, corruption on the part of ruling officials, a sense of deep alienation and distrust between government and citizens. And these were some of the underlying conditions, this sense of the absence of dignity that had led to protests elsewhere in the region. In the interview in January, Bashar suggested that Syria was different. He suggested it was different for two reasons. You mentioned one of them, that he had already embarked on a process of reform, that he was committed to addressing these underlying challenges. That's largely false. That is an image that Bashar has exploited based on a 5 or 6 month experiment with liberalization when he first took over from his father in July 2000, but which was rapidly shut down. And pretty much ever since then, he has tended to govern much more in keeping with the norms of his father than he has as a reformer. Still, he clings to this notion that he has this Western exposure, that he likes computers, that he has medical training, and tries to convey a sense of himself as a reformer. But there was another element to why he thought that Syria could avoid the fate of Egypt or Tunisia, and that had to do with the legitimacy that he felt that accrued to him and his government because Syria had so closely associated itself with policies that were nationalist, that were anti-Western, that were radically pro-Palestinian. Syria was part, if not a leader, of the resistance front, and that identity, it was felt, aligned with the preferences of Syrian citizens and gave the regime some legitimacy. What we've seen in the last 7 weeks is that neither of those claims really had very much substance. Bashar is not a reformer. He resorted, as you pointed out, very quickly to violence when confronted by peaceful protesters. And initially, the protesters were simply demanding reform, not a change of government. And in addition, Syria's identity as a leader of the resistance front meant very little to citizens who felt this absence of dignity, who felt that the regime was corrupt. It's not a mystery why in Deraa, this dusty little southern town on the border with Jordan, where protests became significant for the first time, one of the first targets of protesters was the office of the Syriatel phone company, which was owned by a cousin of Bashar al-Assad, Rami Makhlouf, a man who's become synonymous with corruption, cronyism, predatory behavior by this new economic elite. So Bashar imagined that he could exploit his identity as a reformer and Syria's nationalist credentials to escape the pressures that had produced this uprising in other countries. But he couldn't at the end of the day.
Pile on the irony that here he's claiming a certain street cred as a resistance nation in the Middle East, but the Israelis, it seems, would rather do business with Bashar than the resistance. And the United States, even the Obama administration, is very, very reluctant to turn on the devil we know, Bashar, and the whole Assad story.
Neither government has been as assertive in its criticism of Syria or as supportive of the protesters as they have been in other settings, especially Tunisia and Egypt. But I think for different reasons. I think in the Israeli case, it really is a matter of preferring the devil they know than the uncertainties accompanied with change. And it's important to keep in mind that the Syrian-Israeli border has been peaceful since the disengagement agreements negotiated by Henry Kissinger in the early 1970s. There have been no acts of violence across that border. There are proxy actors like Hezbollah who are a threat. But the Syrian-Israeli border has been quiet. And there is a sense that Syria is a country within Israel, is a country that honors its obligations, that values stability, that is pragmatic and rational in its pursuit of its security interests, and could become, under some conditions, a partner for peace.
But this, again, is where the irony, I mean, your head begins to swim. Is it the devil we know or the devil we need? This mortal enemy across the Golan Heights, whether it's the perspective of Syria or Israel, to have that kind of adversary becomes very useful to maintain your military budgets, but also a certain sense of hysteria in both countries.
Well, I think if Israel were persuaded that it understood what might follow, what a transition to a post-Assad Syria would look like, and had some capacity to gauge the risks associated with that transition, it might take a different view toward what it sees happening in Syria today. It's because the uncertainties are so deep and because it looks at the probable outcomes and sees them as worse than the current situation, that I think it is so reluctant to be at all supportive of the aims of the protesters. There is zero confidence in Israel in the claims by the Syrian opposition that the outcome will be a non-sectarian, democratic Syria. There is a very strong conviction that what will follow if Assad falls is an extended period of social violence followed by a regime which is likely to be deeply sectarian and hostile to Israel and willing to act on that hostility in ways that would challenge Israeli security. So I don't think that there's... Do I believe that? I think it is a possibility that cannot be dismissed. I think we cannot rule out the possibility that the protests in Syria, if they succeed in bringing down the regime, would usher in a period of turmoil, instability, and possibly conflict. And when we look at what's happened in Egypt, from an Israeli perspective, I'm not, you know, this is not necessarily my own view, but when we look at what's happened in Egypt from an Israeli perspective, outreach to Iran, questions about the commitment to the 1979 peace treaty, the role of the Muslim Brotherhood, which I think is painted as a threat in Israel in ways that are exaggerated, but which I think we have to recognize the Israelis themselves view as real. I don't think we can be naive or romantic about what the likely outcome of a successful overthrow of the Assad regime would look like in Syria. And when you're Israel and you share a border with that country, I think you can understand why there is caution and hesitancy. I don't think it has anything to do with whipping up an atmosphere of hysteria or preserving military budgets on either side. For one thing, we've seen two Arab countries, Egypt and Jordan, both authoritarian in different ways at the moment at which they made peace. Overcoming their conflict with Israel had no impact whatsoever on the ability of those governments to sustain themselves as authoritarian regimes. The notion that Syria needs Israel as an enemy to preserve the national security state or the authoritarian regime, I find unpersuasive.
But they do seem to need enemies, used to be the Muslim Brotherhood. Today it may be Al-Qaeda. How do we get to accept good news in this bad situation?
I think we have to be prepared to look at a range of possible outcomes in all of these cases, in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Syria, in Yemen, in Bahrain. And I think we should not dismiss out of hand either the possibility that the spokesmen for the Syrian opposition are right when they claim that their protests are intended to create a democratic, secular Syria. So I don't think we need to necessarily gravitate toward the doom and gloom scenarios. And it seems to me that we have to recognize that even if the regimes that result from these uprisings may articulate policies that we find unhelpful or that challenge U.S. interests in the region, that regimes which rest on a foundation of legitimacy, which express policies that reflect the preferences of their citizens, that provide opportunities for accountability and voice and participation, these are the conditions that promote stability. Illegitimacy is a driver of instability in the region. And to the extent that these regimes were illegitimate, they were not reliable sources of stability. And so we may find ourselves in situations, including in Syria, in which a regime comes to power which is not extremist, not sectarian, not necessarily as closely aligned to Iran or Hezbollah as the current regime is, which nonetheless adopts policies that the U.S. finds unhelpful, but which, because of its legitimacy, actually provides a much more durable basis for U.S.-Syrian relations than we found under the current regime. So, you know, there's an enormous uncertainty that we confront at the moment. We can't, I think, rule out any of the spectrum of outcomes that we're confronted with, but we have to take seriously the possibility that things could go bad, just as we do that they might end up better than they are today.
Steve Heidemann, come back to Bashar Assad. The eye doctor, who might have been a reformer, has turned very, very tough against the protest. Who do we think he really is? And is the tough guy that we see in Damascus today him, or is it his father's lieutenant sort of still calling the tune?
I think it's him. And I think we're seeing the Bashar that we've seen emerge in Syria consistently over the course of the past decade. There is this argument that he's a hostage of the old guard, that there are remnants of his father's inner circle who are hardliners who constrain him, that his own impulse is to be a reformer. I don't think there's any evidence that supports that. He has spent the past decade moving into key positions, his own supporters. He has retained relatively few of his father's leading supporters, officials, allies. And we have seen in several instances over the last decade, Bashar himself endorse policies that were repressive, that cracked down on dissidents and reformers, that drove U.S.-Syrian and Syrian-European relations in a negative direction, and that didn't exploit opportunities that existed to put Syria on a different path. And so we've seen Bashar over the course of a decade now. We have 10 years of experience on which to judge him. And the record is not the record of a reformer.
Is not the unfolding of events fascinating and incredibly surprising? We were talking about Syria. The hardcore Rumsfeld folk used to say, apparently, you know, every man wants boots down in Baghdad, but the real guys want boots down in Damascus. We're going to take those suckers out. Barack Obama kind of stuck his neck out that, no, these are the people, including Iran, that we're going to have to talk to. We've got to have an active diplomacy. Nowadays, his own people are rising up against him, and we seem still hooked on the relationship.
A couple of points. First, the rhetoric of the U.S. response to Syria has been far tougher than it has in many other cases. The language has been far sharper, far more critical.
From
in relation to Yemen, to Bahrain, certainly those are the two cases.
What's the meanest thing that Hillary Clinton or the president has said?
They have recently, Friday, the White House released a statement, and Secretary Clinton reinforced it, that made clear that the sanctions approved the week before could be expanded, that made clear, and this was the big shift, that the U.S. would begin to assess its relationship with Syria based on the behavior of the Syrian government and whether it changed or not in its treatment of protesters. That gets to a critical question, which really just builds on what you were asking, engagement. And is engagement a viable strategy? I think Obama moved toward engagement after many years in which the failure of the Bush strategy of isolating and sanctioning these regimes had become increasingly evident. It was getting us nowhere. And it made sense, it seems to me, under those circumstances to shift course. Obama did. And we are now at a point in Syria in which we have expressed publicly that we will reevaluate whether that strategy should continue to define U.S.-Syrian relations. Mm-hmm. Now, on one hand, you could say that holds open the possibility that this regime and the U.S. might continue to find ways to work together if Bashar shifts course. But there's the other side in which we are threatening the Syrian regime with a shift in its relationship with the U.S. to a far more negative footing. And we're encouraging Bashar to think about whether he wants to go down that road, given everything that it implies.
Of course, they're practiced at not caring or pretending not to care. Do they?
Well, I think they don't care in fact. And if you look at the behavior of the Assad regime over the last decade, they have moved systematically to insulate themselves from the economic and diplomatic and political pressure that the U.S. and the West can bring to bear on them. They have diversified their diplomatic ties to the East, Russia and China. They have built connections to emerging middle powers like Brazil and Turkey. The countries which abstained when the UN sanctioned Syria were Brazil, Turkey, Russia, and China, and India. So you have Syria with a set of international ties that insulate it from Western pressure. And it has figured out how to continue to operate, to survive, even under very severe sanctions. So I think it is able to say, do your worst. We've absorbed it before. We can absorb it again. And we're confident we can manage.
Go big picture on the Arab Spring, in which Syria is one very particular case, but they're all particular cases, and there's no real pattern yet, especially of how the United States responds to insurgencies. We were late getting the news of Tunisia or getting aboard events in Egypt. We're half into the battle in Libya. We seem to be still sort of pro-regime in Syria. Of course, we're pro-regime still with Israel with respect to the West Bank, which has barely had an insurgency, a new one. But where will Syria be seen in the grand history of whatever it is we're living through?
I want to touch on one thing you said first and then do the meta thing.
Sure.
The U.S. is not supportive of the regime in Syria. I think what has driven the reluctance of the U.S. to take a more assertive stance towards Syria is a recognition of how tightly Syria is interwoven into such a broad web of critical strategic relationships in the region. The relationship with Iran, the relationship with Hezbollah, its place in the Arab-Israeli conflict. All of these make Syria a case in which the consequences of a successful uprising could have region-wide effects. And that tends to induce a bit of caution. You know, you're not going to be pushing hard when you have the possibility that by pulling this one domino out of the pile, the ripple effects could be huge. It doesn't mean you don't want the change, but it means that there's a degree of caution about it that there might not be in the case of Libya, which strategically was irrelevant for the region. That's not Syria. But your bigger question is an important one. There is no narrative. The U.S. has no narrative for how to talk about these uprisings. That, I think, is one of the most significant failures of the Obama administration. But it's an intentional result of the way the Obama administration has pursued these events. There was a conscious decision to treat them on a case-by-case basis. And there was a conscious decision that it would look at the U.S. relationship with the country, its strategic position, its importance in a variety of
its oil reserves,
whether the country is homogeneous or heterogeneous. There's a great deal of fear that removing authoritarian regimes and heterogeneous societies will unleash conflicts that could be very difficult to put back in the bottle. And so it has intentionally pursued a case-by-case strategy. But as a result, when asked about what the U.S. thinks about these enormous transformations, it has very little it can say at that general level. It has tried to say, we view this as an opportunity, that we see this as a chance to rebuild relationships with regimes that will be more legitimate and that will more truthfully faithfully express the preferences of their citizens. We recognize that our relationships will become more complex, but we think this is a critical opportunity for the U.S. There's been a lot of pushback against that view by all kinds of voices within Washington who think that we should not abandon our existing allies, who think that the key to U.S. security is to reaffirm our support for existing allies, who think that these transformations pose significant risks and that we shouldn't be too rash in how we embrace them.
But on the contrary pressure, people like me who would love to signal tremendous hope and belief and encouragement, enthusiasm for this rather amorphous thing called the Arab revolt.
There is that's a strand of the debate in Washington, that what we're seeing is such a monumental shift driven by people who simply want better lives for themselves and their families, that we have an obligation to be hopeful about where these changes might lead the region, but that is a voice that it reflects one among many perspectives jostling to try to define how the U.S. engages these changes, and I think we have to acknowledge it has some power. It's a part of the debate that people have responded to, that officials have responded to, but I think it's not the only consideration affecting how the U.S. weighs the way it engages.
Speak for yourself, Steve Heidemann. I mean, how would you fill this rather strange vacuum of a master narrative, even among us Americans, specifically among us Americans, how would you tell the big story of what's happening in the Arab world nowadays, including Syria?
I tend myself toward a narrative of opportunity. Because what I see are societies which are becoming mobilized and politically conscious and politically active in an effort to play a larger role in shaping their own political circumstances, in defining their own economic and political and social futures. And to me, that is an extraordinary story. And it's a story that is fundamentally hopeful. And it's a story which rejects the dominant narratives that Arab citizens were fed by their regimes over the last 40 or 50 years about the imperative of maintaining these national security regimes, about the potential for Muslims to serve as sources of instability and conflict, Muslim extremists. What we're seeing is really a rejection of the way Arab leaders talked about politics, talked about themselves, talked about their citizens as requiring a heavy hand. You know, Arabs need a strong leader. They need strong men to control them. What a paternalistic, condescending way to talk about hundreds of millions of people. And those views are being rejected by Arabs themselves. And I think we have to see that as enormously hopeful in the end. It again, I recognize that what results from this in Egypt and in Tunisia may be much more complicated for the U.S. in terms of managing these relationships. But if we're interacting with societies that are seen by their citizens as fundamentally legitimate, I have to think that at the end of the day, those relationships will be better off.
Steve Heidemann, thank you for sharing so much experience and insight on Syria and the rest of it. This is good to hear.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to talk.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feedback on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.